Tonight on Arena, Michael Sheen and David Tennant as themselves in the lockdown comedy Staged, and no Glastonbury this year, but Una Mullally and Donal Scanlon share their best Glastow memories. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Staged sees David Tennant and Michael Sheen playing fictional versions of themselves. The pair were due to star in a production of six characters in search of an author in the West End, but COVID-19 has put pay to that, and their director, Simon Evans, is determined not to let the opportunity pass him by. He knows how big a chance this is for him and has cajoled his stars into rehearsing via Zoom. I'm joined now by Simon Evans to tell me more, which I better explain straight away. Simon Evans, who directs this piece, also acts in this piece and plays himself in this piece, or a kind of a version of himself, I hope, Simon, or this conversation could be brief.
Yeah, that's right. I write it as well. So whichever version of Simon you prefer, I'm responsible for that one, whether it's the one on the show or this guy here. Whichever version I'm responsible for it, I guess.
You know, the way that this is, the way that this plays out, you know, we are in your home. I think, in fact, mm-hmm. your parents' home. Your sister is there with you.
That's right.
We are in David Tennant's home. His wife and partner and family are there with him in the background. And yep. We're in Michael Sheen's home, and his partner and young child, I think, are there in the background as well. So whose idea was it? Look, we can't get out and about to do anything, or we can do very little out and about. So let's just put some cameras in people's houses and get on with it.
Sure. Well, it was a thing that was actually about to happen to me. I was about to start rehearsing a play for the Chichester Festival here in England, and that was all cancelled because of everything that's been happening in the world, obviously. And there was a little idea earlier on that my two leading actors, while everything was still on the rise but nothing had been locked down yet, would I be able to sort of get them on a call and maybe have a little chat with them and perhaps even rehearse a little bit? And then that sort of came to nothing because the lockdown happened, the theatres were shut and we all went our separate ways. But the idea sort of lingered, and my producer, Finn Glynn, who I was about to make a film with, started talking to me about something else we could make, and I told him about my particular upset not being able to direct my play, and he thought we could capitalize on my misery and turn that into something else.
Okay, so can I just clarify then for myself, because I'm never sure where real life starts and ends in this piece, in a good way, that has to be said. Were you about to direct six characters in search of an author?
No, I wasn't about to direct that. So no, I was about to direct Tom Stoppard's The Real Thing.
And were David Tennant and Michael Sheen involved?
Neither of those. Okay. That's where the universes divide. But Finn knew David, so we sort of had an idea of this thing being a double act and it being shot the only way that we could at the time. Mm. And Finn knew David, so we managed to get it to David, and David knew Michael, and David took it to Michael, and suddenly we sort of had a thing, and we made the pilot. Just all of us, not for any money or sort of gain or with any sort of aspiration, except why don't we have a go at this and see if it's got any legs at all. And we made the first one and we showed it to some people and people seemed to like it. So suddenly we were making five more. And here we are now, a couple of months later, with six of them.
All right. Now, again, I'm still so delightfully confused about where real life and fictional life exist in this piece. And that, I guess, is the whole point of it in some ways.
Sure.
So let's have a listen to a clip from early on in the series, in fact, in the very first episode. And David Tennant as David Tennant and Michael Sheen as Michael Sheen are discussing the whole idea of rehearsing via Zoom.
So Simon wants to rehearse a play over the internet.
It'll be fun. It's a funny play.
Is it?
We'll make it funny. You know Simon speaks Italian?
I speak Italian.
We all speak Italian. Everyone speaks Italian. So, come on, what do you think? You up for it?
Oh, hang on a minute. Thanks, babe.
Did Anna just bring you wine, Michael?
Hi, David.
Hi, Anna.
Hi, good to see you.
And you. It's a bit early, isn't it?
What time did you get up this morning?
About 8.
Yeah, well, I was up at 5 for the dawn. So I'm 3 hours ahead of you, and it's after 6. Cheers!
Yeah, it's still a bit early for the wine, I think, though. Michael Sheen and David Tennant there in a clip from Staged, and the writer, director, and other star, or one of the other stars of the piece.
Sorry that I've made it so complex. Yeah, you should try being in my head for a bit. It's a nightmare now.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah, because you have to talk to the writer, director, and the actor, Simon Evans, all three of them. And we did hear Anna Lundberg in the midst of that, who mm-hmm. is Michael Sheen's partner. By the way, we see you arriving up to beautiful house, which is your parents' house, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's correct,
I didn't like you for that bit. Sorry about that. No, that's real life.
I understand. Yeah, I escaped here before the lockdown happened. I'm usually based in London, but sort of smelling what was on the horizon, I thought if I'm going to be cooped up anywhere, nicer to be in a place in the Oxfordshire countryside than cooped up in London.
I can understand that. Now, David Tennant sounds in that piece, he's a great actor, obviously. He sounds in that piece as if he knows you intimately, or he knows some Simon Evans intimately. Do you know either David Tennant or Michael Sheen in any way, shape or form? Have you met them? Have you worked with them?
No, the sort of strange joy of this whole thing is that we've made this whole thing, but none of us have actually met physically yet to shake hands, share a drink, raise a glass, whatever it is that you might do. No, I sort of had a chat with them, with, again, our producer, with David and Michael, and David's wife, Georgia, Michael's partner, Anna. And we just had a very quick sort of half an hour chat where Finn and I went, it's going to be something like this. Then I went off and wrote the pilot based on sort of what I knew of them in the sort of public sphere and what I'd been able to garner from them in that sort of half an hour. So the pilot was very much informed by, let's just give these guys a sort of character that is a slight version of themselves that they seem comfortable with. And then we were sort of increasingly aware that we would have little conversations, me, David and Michael, while we were rehearsing the sort of earlier episodes, and bits, snitches of those conversations would make their way into episodes 3, 4, 5 and 6. So I was sort of listening to everything they say and laughing along and surreptitiously writing everything down in a notebook.
So did David Tennant and Michael Sheen, who come across in this as the best of friends, who, you know, Wales and Scotland, never the twain shall meet type of thing, and who are quite happy to slag each other about styles of acting. Yeah, David Tennant is accused at one stage by Michael Sheen of being quite cartoonish. Michael Sheen is accused by David Tennant at one point. He says, come on, I can't hear a word you're saying. Will you articulate the thing properly? You're supposed to be classically trained. So were they quite, how well did they know each other, or were they quite happy to run with these kind of, let's face it, laughing at actors and the type of things actors might do?
Yeah, well, they are really good friends. They made Good Omens for Amazon last year, and that was a huge hit for them and for that sort of channel as well. And that was such a huge thing for so many people. And so they are really close friends since then. So it was a joy when David said he would take it to Michael, because the idea of having people that already have that shorthand is just a gift for someone like me to be able to work with. And the thrill then was, in Good Omens, David is the slightly more anarchic character and Michael is a bit sort of softer. Michael's the angelic character in that. So it was nice straight away to go, what if we reverse that as well? But all the way through, they were such, because we were sort of blessed by some sort of very brave guest stars as well, who sort of pop up in the show. And I think it was only because David and Michael were quite so happy to send themselves up and to allow the other person to have the last word sometimes, knowing that they would probably get the last word next time, that meant that these other people came in and were happy to send themselves up as well. So, no, they've just been, I don't think it would have worked if anything was too, took itself too seriously, but hopefully everyone's just tongue-in-cheek enough to...
Okay, well, so I'm going to give away one of the guest stars, because this has already gone out. I'm not going to give away anyone for about tonight, because that's such a joy. I've seen the preview and should be left to enjoy when it happens, to be enjoyed when it happens. This is Samuel L. Jackson. Ken, I don't even know how you approach Samuel L. Jackson and say, we want you to pretend that you were offered this part, but in fact then you would have to do some movie, and Michael Sheen was given it and said. So David Tennant is here speaking by Zoom to Samuel L. Jackson about the fact that, look, it didn't kind of work out, and we've got another guy called Michael Sheen to do it. Samuel L. Jackson, as the character Samuel L. Jackson, this is, has a fairly colourful mouth, it has to be said. He likes to use the vernacular very, very broadly and very widely.
I'll talk to my assistant and I'll call her.
Well, I wouldn't, because she doesn't like you very much now. She doesn't want you to derail the show, and so she went straight out and she hired another actor.
Who?
Michael Sheen.
Who the fuck is Michael Sheen?
Some Welsh, British You'll know him. He was in Good Omens. We were. Frost Nixon. Passengers. Twilight.
Any of these movies making any goddamn money? Do you want to do this with him?
Of course I don't. I worked with him once. I want to do this with you. But here we are. We're stuck. And Joe won't let us change.
Tell you what. I'll call Joe.
I wouldn't. She's not easy to talk to, she's angry. I'd let her cool down. In the fullness of time, when the dust has settled, you and me will move on and we'll do something else, something better.
That's Samuel L. Jackson and David Tennant there in a scene from Stitch. Probably the cleanest section of that scene, it has to be said, in terms of language, Simon.
Yeah, I didn't know if you were going to use it on Unadulterated, but what a thrill to hear that at 10 past 7.
Well, it is the language of the character, let us be clear, and the language within the piece itself, rather than you or I using it, which would be totally unacceptable. Let me be clear with you on that one, putting on my schoolmarm voice. But at any rate, it does bring up an aspect that we get here, because the David Tennant character is quite a sneak in that respect. All of the actors, Michael Sheen is very, very happy with how he would never have been second choice for any role in his life. Samuel L. Jackson is portrayed as vain, pretty artless, and just having this mansion in Hollywood, and that's all he has to offer. You work with actors, or at least up until this point you worked with actors. How many of them are going to want to work with you now after you've shown your true opinion of them?
I think you're absolutely right. I'm in trouble now, so I'm pleased to be here just to let everyone know that I'm available for any work now. That's not just I think in two respects: A, my contempt for actors seems to come through, and also my own complete ineptitude as a director seems to come through in the character of Simon in the show as well.
Yeah.
No, I'm joking. I mean, it's a luxury to have actors of that sort of caliber who are happy to sort of poke fun at this. I mean, I don't think whatever our aspiration was for this show, the sort of rules we set ourselves were that we wouldn't mention coronavirus, that word wouldn't pop up, that we wouldn't in any way try to make it worthy, and we wouldn't try to apologize for anything. It would just be, you know, the conditions of the world have meant that David Tennant and Michael Sheen have to communicate via Zoom. And if they do, what sort of scrapes might they get into when there's nobody else to furnish ego?
Can I just ask you a little bit about the technicalities of that? Because I wondered about this as I watched the episodes. To what extent there was actual interaction taking between Michael Sheen at home in his house and David Tennant at home in his house and you at home in your house? To what extent real interaction took place there, or to what extent have you got amazing editors who made it look like real interaction?
Well, it's a really good question. There's a little bit of both. Certainly a shout out to Dan Gage, who was our incredible editor on the show. We did manage to have some actual interaction, because while the sort of cameras on the computer were recording individuals, we were on a call at the same time, on a video call, so everyone could bounce off each other. But Dan did an amazing job of tightening those little moments up if ever we were delayed by connections or all of those issues that everyone is now so bored with. So we did manage to have all those things. And there are also a couple of bits where a take didn't work and we've had to get one of the actors redoing their part without the other actor there, just trying to time it up with the video that we've got of the other person. So there's all of that. It's as you would imagine with anything else. When it worked beautifully. And at other times I had to sort of rely on Dan to stitch it together, and Alex Baranowski, whose music sort of hides some of those things as well in a sort of brilliant way. They give it so much personality and slickness, I think.
I suppose like your average Zoom call, really, isn't it? You know, where
all
of us speak together for the first two or three of those calls, and then we find a way of not doing that.
Sure,
and then
exactly.
We shout over each other anyway when we've learned that new way.
Exactly. And just that thing about Zoom calls, which is that you can just sort of walk away and you can shut it down, and you can, you know, get lost in it, and you can sit in quiet with each other as well. It's a strange sort of new habit that we've fallen into.
The other very interesting thing I found about the piece was, you say you didn't want to specifically mention COVID-19, but you kind of hint at it in a very clever way. And it's not specifically in the clip I'm about to play, but I'll explain it after we play the clip. There's a neighbour next door to Michael, a little old woman, as your script refers to her as. And Michael has been rather ungentlemanly in some of his behaviours, as we will hear him explain in this clip about what he does with the wheelie bins outside both houses.
Just during the lockdown, Anna and I have been drinking a little more than usual.
Sure, that's all right.
No, it's not excessive.
No.
But when we emptied the recycling this morning and got ready to put the bottles in the wheelie bin on the road, it did look a bit...
excessive.
Yes.
Yes.
Which is why I'm nervous about leaving the pile on the side of the road outside the house. People know it's me who lives here.
Well, what are you going to do?
I'm going to sneak out tonight and put them in my neighbour's bin.
You can't do that.
Yes, I can.
What if their bin's full?
It won't be. She's 80. She doesn't even recycle properly.
You are sneaking out under cover of night to leave your bacchanalian embarrassment in your octogenarian neighbour's bin.
Bacchanalian embarrassment?
That's right, yes.
Yes, I am.
Anna?
No, don't know.
Anna?
She knows.
Anna!
What?
Hi.
David doesn't agree with our recycling plan.
You know about this plan?
I do.
And you're fine with it?
Would you rather we didn't recycle?
What a great question from Anna Lundberg. Anna Lundberg and Michael Jean planning to put their bottles into their neighbour's bin. How horrible is that? But I mentioned that, Simon Evans, in terms of Staged, which is the BBC lockdown drama that we're speaking about. It cleverly later on, we find out, and I don't want to give anything too much away here, an ambulance comes to the neighbour's house at a later stage, and that becomes a lovely offstage drama. Was that a way of nodding towards COVID-19 without it being a drama about COVID-19?
Yeah, it absolutely was. And I think we sort of wanted to go, we wanted as much as possible to treat David and Michael, while they are, I think, slight parodies of whatever image we might have of them, also like real people who have concerns about things. And so David becomes a little sort of aimless, I suppose, as a person locked in that house and doesn't quite know what to do and becomes, you know, a slight burden almost on Georgia in it. And Michael, on the other hand, starts to sort of worry about the people around him a little bit more. So it was a way of giving us something else for them to reflect on that wasn't just always internal. And, you know, we've all heard those stories about bottles being left out and, you know, people's consumption going up a little bit more. And that was the sort of first joke of an idea that then suddenly became, well, we all have people that we're concerned about as well. Yeah. And it was lovely for that. Those actors are so brilliant because they can turn on a dime. Absolutely. And they can take you from somewhere a bit silly to suddenly something quite serious has just insisted upon itself. And yeah, we absolutely wanted to nod to it and make it something about how we're all feeling and a bit helpless.
Okay. I'm just wondering, finally, you've obviously had them in lockdown now, but I'm thinking of Steve Coogan and Ross Bryden and The Trip. Could you persuade Michael Sheen, Rob Rydenberger in The Trip, could you persuade Michael Sheen and David Tennant to continue with this in some way?
Well, we'd love to. I mean, it would be such a treat to, and I think everyone's had a really good time doing it. I think it's a thing of its moment, and I think part of its connection with people is the Zoom calls and the ways that they have been locked inside. So I wouldn't wish for our world to continue in such a way that this was the only way we were forced to make work like this. But if I got a chance to work with those guys again, I'd do it in a heartbeat, especially if I'm just writing them as them again. That would be a dream.
Yeah, but you have to be you in it as well, Simon Evans.
Oh, God, even worse.
Okay, that's Simon Evans speaking to us there. The final two episodes of Stage will be on BBC One tonight. Well worth watching just for the guest star in the final episode alone. In more normal times, many Irish people would now be packing up the tent or the camper van and heading over to Glastonbury Music Festival, which was due to take place this very weekend in Somerset. Instead, we'll have to content ourselves with a best-of selection of performances, which will be broadcast across the BBC from Thursday, tomorrow night, through until Sunday. Which, to be fair, that's not really a hardship. As I expect this is the way that many of you listening this evening like to enjoy the delights of Glastonbury rather than with muddy feet. The festival has been going on since the early 1970s, but in more recent times it has become a rite of passage for musicians and music fans alike, with the capacity to transform the fortunes of a performer lucky enough to hit on a bit of magic on stage. Two seasoned Glastonbury attendees, Una Mullally and Donald Scannell, join me now to reminisce on the good times and remind us of some of the truly legendary performances. Let's give you both quite a broad question on it. First of all, starting with you, Una, what is it? This is, and be as brief as you can, what is it that makes Glastonbury such an important music festival?
I guess it's the mothership, really, and the kind of format of music in a big field, you know, that we see all over the world stems from that. So I suppose it's a mixture of the place, the atmosphere, the legacy, the scale, the number of people there, the diversity of artists, and the fact that everybody kind of really, really wants to be there. So it has this very joyful vibe all across the 5 days. I suppose it is that thing that it is so big, which I think some people find intimidating, but it's multiple festivals in one. So you can enter at your own pace and create your own kind of experience throughout it. You're not plunged into a pre-formatted kind of atmosphere. Yeah. So.
And I think it's often in the case with any big festival, Edinburgh, I suppose, being, you know, an even bigger overall arts festival. Don't go thinking you're going to get to see everything. You're not going to be able to do that. Don't try to do that. Choose what you want to see and make your movement around the place accordingly. And in fact, you have said, Donal Scannell, as well, you know, that it's not only is it a big festival in and of itself, but the BBC's involvement has made it into something else again.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, now for big acts playing Glastonbury, you're playing to a massive TV audience with a live audience in between. And I think the TV audience has become more important for the bigger acts in recent years. And it's become a massive game changer. Like, I know it's the biggest single audience for a TV show, for a music TV show that the BBC get any year now, are the headliners at Glastonbury. It's become absolutely huge.
Now, video didn't kill the radio star, but can television coverage kill the field festival, do you think, Donal? Is that a good thing that the BBC is so involved now?
No, it's a great thing, because the main stage of the festival, the Pyramid stage and the other stage, I kind of see them as like Grafton Street and O'Connell Street, and they're what pays for everything. And they allow the entire Glastonbury ecosystem to exist. So if loads of eyeballs are on those, they get lots of attention, lots of people want to go. It allows all the other weird and crazy stuff that's up high, up in the hills to exist. And that for me is where the real Glastonbury exists. Like, I don't really bother going down to Grafton Street and O'Connell Street much when I'm at Glastonbury. I've seen more of those acts on the telly since I've stopped going to Glastonbury in real life than I ever did at the festival itself.
Well, that might be an age thing as much as anything else, that you like to watch it on the television now. So I'm going to bring you back probably more youthful times, Una, if I can, and 2008, round about this time, maybe yesterday or the day before, you must have been packing up to head over towards your very first Glastonbury in 2008. How excited were you at that time? What are your memories of heading there for the first time?
I was really excited. I was going on with a music writer in the Tribune at the time, Neil Dunphy, and I was really kind of intimidated and like just nervous, I suppose. You get those kind of, you know, the Schkettiminoch type vibe before you head over somewhere. And I remember we were camping at that stage. You could camp backstage, basically. I think we were kind of behind the Pyramid stage. And that was a really interesting year because Jay-Z was headlining. There was all this ridiculous discourse around whether or not a rapper could headline the festival. And it had impacted sales. Like, I remember on going over, I think I went over on the Thursday, which I usually go over on Wednesdays, and you could buy tickets at the gate, you know, which to think about that now is mad. And that's only 12 years ago. But it was, you know, really kind of shifted my understanding of what a festival could be.
Right.
And the sense of a pop-up city, the sense of scale and the sense of, you know, a mass gathering kind of changed. And since then, I just can't really stay away. A lot of my year almost orientates around it.
I guess there must have been a real frisson, or was there a real frisson in the field when Oasis were finishing up their set and JSE was getting ready to come on, because there had been such, as you say, such controversy around this rapper.
I don't know if they were playing. I know that Jay-Z came out. There's been loads of kind of rubbish talk from kind of Noel Gallagher about, you know, having that. And so in response to that, Jay-Z came out to Wonderwall.
Ah, so he played that as his entrance music,
which was a real middle finger to that kind of rockist mentality, and then kind of launched into 99 Problems. And it was just like, you know, I've seen Jay-Z a bunch of times. It just blew the house, the roof off.
Well, here's how it went. Suppose what you get there, Jay-Z in 2008 using Oasis as his entrance music and then really letting us know what he thinks about all of that. Although, you know, at times you don't care the precise nature of what he was saying. But the energy was clearly hugely exciting, Una Mullally.
It was so amazing, and it really, I think, changed. It changed Glastonbury. It brought a new audience in TV wise, and it also, at a time when festivals, you know, festivals being kind of like rooted in a 70s, 80s, 90s white rock mentality, finally responded to what the dominant kind of youth culture is globally, which is hip hop. It changed, you know, the kind of the booking policy in a lot of places. Obviously, Jay-Z was an unbelievable performer before that performance. But, you know, and then Beyonce came and headlined a couple of years later, which reorientated her position, I think, in the culture as this massive, you know, one of the greatest live performers of her generation, and set her on the road to what became known as Beachella, and her ownership over the live space. So really, it did change that somewhat, and kind of that developed again when Stormzy headlined too, and when grime was brought in as a headliner, headlining genre, as opposed to something on the fringes, which really kind of did exist in Glasgow for a while.
The Irish involvement in Glastonbury, how important is it, first of all, within Glastonbury itself, would you say, Donal, and secondly, for the Irish acts?
There's always been a strong Irish contingent there, but like not as dominant as festivals like Primavera would have in terms of Irish people. So it's an amazing festival to get to play, but there wouldn't be, you wouldn't feel you'd see lots and lots of Irish people there, and you know, you wouldn't, which I mean is no bad thing when you're away at a festival, and there's not loads and loads of Irish acts playing every year. There might be half a dozen, and very much playing on their own merits. You never feel like Glastonbury has a token Irish act on different stages. They're not trying to nod to Ireland or pander or anything like that, but especially on the acoustic stage, there'll always be a good smattering of Irish acts, but not for any other reason than the acts themselves.
One of the highlights for you was 2011, however, and you too. Why did this particular performance stand out for you?
To be honest, I was trying to pick stuff that was on the main stage you'd be able to access. And the U2 thing, I think, was very interesting because it was such a tough gig for them. I would have really felt nervous for anyone headlining Glastonbury. It's a tough gig, you know, and you really have to get it right. And there's a real tightrope to walk, and you don't get to bring your normal production. You don't get to take the whole place over for a week in advance to set up. You're playing to a crowd that didn't buy tickets to see you. They bought tickets before you playing was even announced. So you don't even know how many people standing in front of you are going to be fans of yours. And you have to go out there and you have to knock it out of the park, because if you don't, you're toast. Yeah, like, it's a really precarious gig. So I think there was a real tension, and I really felt for them in that regard. I was kind of going, are they going to pull this one off? You know?
Yeah, here they are actually in the middle of a song, I think, trying to do precisely that, trying to pull the crowd, to get the crowd to come with them. And that's you two performing at Glastonbury in 2011. And with me this evening, Una Mullally and Donal Scanlon, with their great memories of their times, various years in Glastonbury. It sounds to me there, Donal, as if they were winning the crowd over. That was at the very beginning of the set, but a little bit into the song. Obviously, come to the end of that first song, in fact.
Yeah, they totally did. No, it was a definite victory, and there was a real atmosphere of accomplishment afterwards. It was great. It was. I can't think of an Irish band who've actually played a slot as big as them in Glastonbury. There's been very, very few like who've really, really had it. I've seen Keela lots of times at Glastonbury. Yeah. Last was at the theatre or the circus tent quite a few years ago, and they, for me, are a classic Glastonbury band, and I saw them play one of the best Keela gigs I've ever seen at Glastonbury, and they really typify for me the melting pot that is Glastonbury, because so many different styles come together, and around the what's called the West Hold stage now in particular, you get all these different musical types meeting, you get all the people coming up from the main stages, you get the people coming down from the hills, and it's that real melting pot. And I mean, the BBC have tried as best they can to capture that off-piece atmosphere, but you really kind of have to go there, and you really have to dive in and go for it and have your comfortable shoes on.
Absolutely. And Sinead O'Connor, of course, played, Ash played, and you were also mentioning, Una Mullally, about Hosier graduating, in fact, to the pyramid stage.
Yeah, he's been quite a strong presence at Glastonbury the last couple of years. And, you know, like Donal is saying, like, the pyramid stage is huge. And it's funny even to think of a band as big as U2 that, you know, they mightn't be able to crack it. But it's such a massive stage. It, you know, during the year, it's its repurposed purpose as a cow shed. But it's a huge stage, and there's a massive gap between the actual kind of front of the stage and the audience. I think Larry Mullen was saying afterwards that he just really didn't like that distance. But Hosier has been managed to kind of hold it. Last year, he played a really good show. And oftentimes, like, the headliner thing is weird, because there are kind of multiple headliners across multiple stages. People think about the three big ones, Friday, Saturday, Sunday on the Pyramid stage. There's also the Legends slot on the Sunday, which is often a massive act. It's an interesting one for the Irish bands. Fontaines DC did really well last year. They played three or four shows, a last minute one in the John Peel stage, which is kind of more indie rock stage, I guess, but a giant tent, you know. Hosier's done really well, and once you can get that pyramid slot, people hang around the pyramid stage, you know, all day. And for a headliner, there could be, you know, around 100,000 people there or something. So if you can get one of those afternoon slots, it can really boost a band's profile internationally.
Later on then, in 2014, it obviously would have been later on in the evening when the legend, as you spoke about there, came out, Dolly Parton. I bet that is, small though she may be in stature, I bet you she had no problem filling that stage. This was one of your choices, I think, as well, Una.
Yeah, that was a really remarkable show. 2014 was an incredibly muddy year. I think Michael Eavis said it was one of the most difficult ever, if not the most difficult weather-wise, because it had been raining so much in the run-up to the festival. And Dolly came on, kind of grey sky. Obviously, everybody loves, you know, everybody with a heart loves Dolly Parton. You're talking about a massive back catalogue of amazing songs. And she just kind of won everyone straight over straight away with her new Glastonbury composition called Mud, which is pretty pedestrian ditty, if I may critique her. Not that I would dare do so, but that legend slot, you know, I've seen people there, like, you know, Leonard Cohen play on the Sunday, Kylie last year, which is a bit of a debate about whether she qualified as a legend yet. There's been Lionel Richie, no amount of kind of really massive acts too. So it's a really beautiful one, and I think it also speaks to the diversity of ages of the crowd at Glastonbury. Like, there can be 17-year-olds running around, listening to techno, and, you know, 70-something-year-olds sitting by the acoustic stage, you know, reading The Guardian and waiting for Sinead to come on, or, like that. So it's a really lovely mix in that sense.
Well, I can only imagine what it'd be like. Even it might have been very muddy and very wet in 2014, but to hear Dolly Parton introduce a song like this, a legend herself and a legendary song.
Are you having fun so far? This is a real thrill and a real treat. Now, how many of you go so far back that you'd remember a song of mine called Jolene?
You've got it, Flaunt. Dolly Parton there in the legend spot at Glastonbury Festival in 2014. Una Mullally and Donal Scannell sharing their memories with me this evening. My producer was saying to me, I don't know which year she was, maybe she'll probably tell me in my ears we're speaking here, Shirley Bassey performing, which she said was amazing. What year was that? Maybe Sinead can tell me if she's hearing me ask that question. What year was Shirley Bassey, Sinead? 2005, 2007, around about that, she remembers. She was there in both those years, so it was one of those 2 years, I'm guessing.
All the years blur into one.
Is that how it goes? Do they blur into one and then just acts stand out for you? Why did Stevie Wonder, not in the legend spot, but headlining, why did he stand out so much for you, Donal?
Because I remember it. We made a point of going to it, and it's one of the few times that we're actually there in time, up the front, waiting. I'd never ever seen Stevie Wonder before, and his entrance was just out of this world. I mean, I'm sure he does it at every single gig he plays, but Stevie comes out and he has this routine that reminds me of Willy Wonka at the start of the original Charlie and the Chocolate Factory film, when he comes out of the factory and he pretends to stumble. Stevie's got a whole routine like that, and it's just, he just had you in the palm of his hands, and you're just there, and you just can't believe that you're there in front of Stevie Wonder at Glastonbury of all places. I mean, it was incredible. And his daughter joins him on stage. It was just beautiful.
Let's have a listen. Stevie Wonder with Superstition from his 2010 headline at Glastonbury. One of the highlights for Donal Scannell from the festival. Are your Glastonbury days over now, Donal? Is that what you're telling me?
Sometimes I wonder. I'd like to try and have one more go if I could, at least. It's kind of funny listening to all these festival clips. I'm trying to not get sentimental for festivals lost in the time that we're in right now. I'm on the verge of tears at times listening to all these clips and wondering when will things be the same again. Right. The hardest thing about going to a festival in advancing years is the pain in your back when you wake up in the morning from sleeping on the hard ground, because the only way to do it is to sleep on site. Going to a B&B in a hotel just doesn't really work. So yeah, if maybe airbed technology has advanced so much since the 10 years I've been there, if I bring a self-inflating airbed, maybe I could do one more.
And no glamping or anything like that. What about you, Una? Have you more Glastonbury's left in you?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I think that I'll be going for the rest of my life, to be quite honest. But, you know, I say that now. Festivals are really my habitat, I guess. And I think that, you know, you're asking earlier about, like, what makes it different. And one of the aspects of it is that it's always changing. Mm. So you can be going repeatedly, but there's always something new to see, be that, you know, a massive new piece of set design. Like last year, they had this huge pier in the middle of the site. Or it could be, you know, just these little new areas. And really the production values are kind of second to none. around creating that very, very immersive atmosphere. And all credit to all of the artists that you kind of don't necessarily see on the stages who are doing these massive, amazing builds. And because that standard is so high, there does seem to be like a competitive nature in a very, you know, collegiate way about how to make it better, how to make it more brilliant without it seeming gimmicky. So you get these brilliant artists from all over the UK just making this really stunning stuff that just, you know, is so thrilling to see, especially, you know, in the depths of the night when you're kind of wandering off and discovering something new.
You were there last year when Stormzy performed. You were there for the famous vest moment, were you, when the vest appeared towards the end of the act?
The Banksy vest, is it? Yeah. Incredible. I mean, that Stormzy show was one of the best, you know, production-wise that I've ever seen. And it's that thing where somebody is stepping up, and Emily Evis talks about this with regards to headliners and Glasgow's kind of lack of diversity over the years about, you know, you have to make headliners and you have to give people a shot. Stormzy had one album at the time, and he comes on with what was effectively like an Olympic opening ceremony.
He appeared with it on, didn't he? It was at the beginning of the act that the vest appeared.
Yeah, this like Union Jack Banksy bulletproof vest. I just thought that was an amazing moment for, you know, Black Britain, for Grime, you know, which had graduated to pop with Stormzy, for him as such a leader in not only in the industry, but in the UK in general, and all the amazing initiatives he's started from, like, you know, scholarships to a publishing house. So I think it was just really amazing. And again, the tension, the expectation, the energy, the waiting, and the moment that this is sink or swim time. And when somebody nails it, there's nothing better.
Well, the crowd were definitely with him. There's no doubt about that. But I want to finish up with a clip of Lizzo, which is another one of these classic moments of a breakthrough moment for an artist. How important was this for her last year? And we'll finish up by listening to her kind of basically communing with the crowd. She really gets the crowd on side.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that's always really exciting with festivals. Billie Eilish last year as well at Glasgow did the same thing. Somebody is really on the up. They're very buzzed about. They're very hot. People know that they're talented. And Glastonbury really centres musicians. And when you are on that trajectory and you do a landmark gig that everyone's talking about, it really gives you momentum. I actually missed the Lizzo show because I went to see Janet Jackson, which really was quite a poor gig. So I'm kind of raging about that. But I did want to see Janet. She's a legend. In her own right, but Lizzo was something that everyone was just talking about the whole weekend.
Well, listen, thanks to both yourself, Una Mullally, and Donal Scanlon for sharing your Glastonbury memories. I'm sure there's lots more Glastonburys in both of you, Donal. Don't give up on it yet. Let's finish up by listening to Lizzo and her moment in Glastonbury 2019.
Damn, we've been through a lot together. I feel like we family now. I want you to know that I love you very much and I'm very proud of you. I want you to know if you can love me, you can love your goddamn self. And if you don't mind, I'd like to do a little mantra with you. I want you to go home tonight and look in the mirror and say, I love you, you are beautiful, and you can do anything. I really want you to say that because I believe we can save the world if we save ourselves first. It starts with you. I'm one bitch, but y'all are thousands and thousands of bitches. And you all can change the world. So right now I want you to say to me, I love you. You are beautiful. And you can do anything. Now I want you to look at the person next to you and say, I love you. You are beautiful. And you can do anything. I want you to keep that love there. Are you ready to do your hair toss and check your nails, ho? How we feeling? Woo, child, tired of the bullshit. keep it moving. Yes, Lord. Time to get some new shit in this one. We're going to the pool shit. Come now, come dry.
Lizzo there with Good As Hell from her 2019 appearance at Glastonbury. The BBC's TV coverage begins tomorrow. The coverage begins tomorrow night. BBC 4 with Julian Temple's 2006 documentary simply called Glastonbury. That's at 10 p.m. Continues then on BBC 2 and 4 across the weekend. Sets from Beyonce, Jay-Z, David Bowie and many, many more. Pan Pan Theatre Company run a mentorship programme for theatre practitioners, and tomorrow the seventh such mentorship programme comes to a close with an online event giving insight into the making of contemporary theatre. To give a taste of what this mentorship involved, I'm joined now by Sarah Gordon, who lives and works in Belfast and who wrote the show Billy, which was at the 2018 Dublin Fringe. And Sarah was mentored on the Pan Pan programme by the Nature Theatre of Oklahoma's Kelly Cooper, who also joins me on the line from New York, which is the home of her company. More of that in a moment. But Sarah, let's start with you. A playwright you are, for the most part, I think it's fair to say, Sarah, and recently completed a short film called Just the Two of Us, going out tonight, tomorrow night, in fact, on BBC Northern Ireland. Tell me a little bit about that film.
Basically, my husband and I were kind of caught a bit short, and as everyone is, you know, you're just sitting in the house kind of looking at the walls. And we made a little short film about this couple working from home together. Karen is meticulous. And Simon, her husband, is a lot more relaxed. He's kind of throwing himself into his hobbies. Yeah. And that's not really what Karen's about. But it's about how in the face of a global pandemic, this couple's biggest challenge is spending time together.
I think a few people have had that experience. BBC Arts and Lyric part of that, and it's splendid. But the Splendid Isolation Project, Thursday night at 10 p.m. on BBC Northern Ireland. So the mentorship scheme then, what was the attraction of this Pan Pan scheme for you?
Well, I had actually been to the symposium, which is what we're doing tomorrow. I'd been to one of those for a previous version of Pan Pan's mentorship program, and was really excited by it. Was really excited by the artists involved and the opportunity to work with an international practitioner, which, I mean, that rarely happens, you know. So I really wanted to be involved and applied for it and was accepted onto the program and was really excited.
So, Kelly, you were the international arts practitioner, Kelly Cooper, of the Nature Theatre of Oklahoma. And let's get out of the way. The Nature Theatre of Oklahoma is based in New York. Why that title of the Nature Theatre of Oklahoma?
We actually took our name from Kafka's novel America. The last chapter is called Nature Theatre of Oklahoma. And this guy who's been looking for a job his whole, like, he's an immigrant to America, which, you know, my partner comes from Slovakia. He has a series of really bad jobs, and he ends up joining the Nature Theatre of Oklahoma.
Now, you worked as the mentor on this Pan Pan Theatre Company. Did you work specifically with Sarah, or were you working with a number of Irish or of different theatre artists, Kelly?
I'm working with four. Sarah, I've got all their names too. they're all quite different. You know, some come from dance, some come from performance, and Sarah's more rooted in writing.
Well, let's talk about the idea that you had, Sarah, because it was one thing to start out with, I think it's safe to say, and it became something very different as history catches up on things, as it quite often does. What was the initial idea that you thought you might work with Kelly on?
Well, I was really interested in monuments. Pretty kind of a hot topic at the minute, but I was really interested in the kind of connection between tourism and terrorism and how those two things are really interlinked. I grew up in the shadow of a big World War One obelisk, you know, so it was very normal to, you know, there are a lot of very contentious monuments around Northern Ireland and across the world. And I live now beside one of the peace walls in Belfast. So there are like 97 separate interfaces or barriers that are kind of dotted around interface areas of Belfast, and it's become just part of the it's part of the vernacular of the area. You know, you don't really notice it unless you're driving home at 11 o'clock and you can't get through the gate, so you've to grind a long way. But I was interested in how statues and monuments are kind of representational objects. You know, they're interchangeable. You know, they're like props. They can kind of be anything, but they're sort of representational and they serve a purpose to commemorate something. But very often the fact of the person who's commemorating it is usually it's the people who are in power and the people who have the money.
Yes.
And I was interested in how an object or a memorial can become so socially loaded that people want to take it down.
And quite definitely, obviously, that caught up on you in recent times. Now, you're a tour guide on Crumlin Road, so you'd have been familiar with lots of these various tourism sites. But let me ask Kelly a little bit then about how the news has shifted, perhaps, attitudes around monuments and certainly shifted how you might have to treat them in a theatrical context, particularly with Black Lives Matter and the protests putting a new focus on monuments and statues. That's an important part of your theatre practice, Kelly, I think, that immediacy of reaction.
That's just kind of what makes theatre special is, it's not like a painting that's made in its time. It's made with and for an audience that's occupying the same time of its making, you know. So you're always taking into account that the audience comes in with their own text and with their own minds, and that's constantly changing, you know, along with the world we live in. They bring the world in from outside, and you have to kind of deal with that as an added text in the performance.
What did the mentorship bring or do for you, Sarah Gordon, then, finally, would you say?
I think the really brilliant thing about what Pam Pam kind of seek to do is that they find people who have an idea that's still in sort of a seed stage. So because of that, it is quite vulnerable to external forces. So that's why when something like, you know, a big shift in news or conversation takes hold, you kind of end up, you know, being pulled in different directions. And where I kind of had originally been going with this tourism idea, I was a little bit pulled off kilter. And so I think having Kelly there as a person to kind of gravitate towards and you know, keep you on course, she did, you know, we had lots of conversations about how important it is to kind of hold on to the thing that keeps you excited about the project, because then if you lose that, you lose interest, you know.
All right, that's Sarah Gordon there and Kelly Cooper speaking to me about the Pan Pan Mentorship Programme, the 7th International Mentorship Programme, coming to an end at the moment. Pan Pan hosting a series of free online symposium hours over 3 consecutive weeks starting tomorrow, Thursday the 25th of June at 4 p.m. PanPanTheatre.com will give you all of the details there, and Sarah Gordon's film, Just the Two of Us, is on BBC Two on Thursday night at 10 p.m. as part of Splendid Isolation, the lockdown drama series. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Paddy Carney was on sound this evening. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.